The following lecture was delivered at the 15th Annual National Jewish Retreat in Atlanta, Georgia, a project of the Rohr Jewish Learning Institute. We hope you enjoy it, and we encourage you to visit jretreat.com for information on upcoming retreats. Rabbi Pinchas Taylor now presents his lecture, You Will Yet Live Again.
So I want to look at the next 50 minutes as a crash course, everything that you need to know about reincarnation, some of the things you might have been curious about, never had an opportunity to ask about. Here is your chance. So here we go. Reincarnation is the name of the idea that souls are born in another body after they've passed away from a prior body. It's believed in a variety of ancient cultures. It was a belief that was held by ancient Greeks, including the philosophers Pythagoras, Socrates, Plato. Some of the greatest minds in shaping Western civilization as well also believed in the idea of reincarnation. They accepted it as a premise, as something that was a sure thing. Many are surprised to know, though, that in addition to being a belief that's held in spiritual circles, that there's actually been investigations on this in scientific circles, and something that has a very strong presence in Jewish literature as well. So let's dive into it a little bit. Now, when it comes to scientific studies and research with regard to reincarnation, there are quite a number of reputable and highly qualified medical professionals that have been involved in the study of reincarnation. And some of them, the most interesting among them, are the ones that started off as skeptics themselves, and then through the process of their investigation, became believers. One very famous example, many people have perhaps even read his books, is Brian Weiss. Brian Weiss was chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at Mount Sinai Hospital, where I'm from, in Miami, South Florida. In 1980, a woman came to him with a problem. He names her in the book Catherine. It wasn't her real name. But Catherine comes to Brian Weiss, Dr. Brian Weiss, for some help. And she steps into his office and she talks about some severe phobias that she has that don't allow her to function properly, live a healthy life. And after using some of the conventional methods that he would use in psychotherapy, Dr. Weiss decided he was going to hypnotize her. And through the state of hypnosis, to try to get down deeper into where these issues, where these phobias are coming from. And in her next session, under hypnosis, she described in great detail a tragedy that happened in her village 1,000 years prior. Now, Dr. Weiss at the time was a highly educated intellectual. He was someone who had published many works in psychiatry and psychology, textbooks even. He was very skeptical about this type of spiritual past lives and anything that had to do with this sort of thing. But as he continued his work with Catherine, he saw improvement. See, what was happening originally when, as a therapist himself, usually when a person gets to the bare bones of the issue that is bothering them, once that has been identified and discussed, some of the phobias or some of the symptoms that are related to that tend to go away. They weren't going away with Catherine. But once she mentioned about this tragedy in her village from 1,000 years ago, some of the symptoms, some of the phobias that she started that she was having began to be alleviated. And so Brian Weiss was very intrigued, very skeptical about the whole thing, but he was intrigued. He was especially intrigued with her tremendous attention to detail. It wasn't just, it was 1,000 years ago, I was living in a Viking village. It was with extraordinary detail. something that her imagination couldn't have just come up with on her own. And through various hypnosis sessions and discussions with her, he became a believer. The icing on the cake was when, through their discussion with Catherine under hypnosis, she would speak about the world of souls and said that she had encountered Brian Weiss's father, who had since passed away, and even identified him by his Hebrew name, Avraham. And so this was the icing on the cake that turned Brian Weiss, skeptic psychiatrist, into a believer in reincarnation. Now his books are Many Lives, Many Masters, and he goes around speaking about this particular subject. Again, I'm not here to endorse or to discredit the work of Brian Weiss, but what we're saying is that reincarnation has found a place even amongst the scientific community. Dr. Helen Wambach, another example where she went out on a mission to disprove cases of reincarnation. Not only was she herself a skeptic, but she actually went out to disprove reincarnation. And so she wound up, she conducted a study with over 1,000 participants who had claimed that they had some sort of connection, open connection with their past lives. And in her discussions, she was able to find in the vast, vast majority confirmation for the stories that she was being told about the historical era, about the clothing, about the footwear even, that these people claimed to have once lived in. And so through all of her discussions and journaling about what was going on, she came to realize that there's much more to this than she initially gave credence to. So again, she started not only as a skeptic herself, but was seeking to disprove that reincarnation is not a thing, or certainly not a thing that can be proven. Another interesting example we find is Dr. Ian Stevenson, who has a particular interest in the study when it comes to children. He was the department head of psychiatric medicine at the University of Virginia, and he spent 40 years going through 3,000 cases of children who claimed to had past lives or to remember aspects of their past lives. And astoundingly, in over 40 of Dr. Stevenson's cases, not only were there recollections of a prior life, but there were physical examples on the person in this particular life. So if the child claimed that they, in a prior life, were injured or murdered, there would be a scar on the child in this life. And so Dr. Stevenson has written tremendous amounts. And always when research in this particular area is done with children, it's more interesting because children don't hold back, and they also is less likelihood in them trying to have any, making anything up. And so Dr. Stevenson was known as a very careful, methodical, conservative sort of researcher, not trying to be make a popular opinion about anything. But he writes extensively that there's something to this. There's something to these claims. It's not just made up stuff. So again, throughout the scientific community, we've found that this is something that is at least worthy of investigation. It's intriguing. There's something to it. One of the most wonderful and amazing examples that happened very recently, relatively, everything's relative, right? There was a little boy named James Leninger, who in the year 2000 was 2 years old. And this is a very chilling story of reincarnation. He was living in Louisiana at the time with his parents, Bruce and Andrea. And James, from the time that he was 2 years old, he would start having these recurring nightmares. Every night, he would dream, and his parents would hear from the other room. They'd come rushing in the room, and they'd see James still asleep, but kicking in the air and screaming, "Plane down, little man can't get out." And his parents were beginning to wonder, what's this all about? And so when they talked to him, and as he got older and was able to express himself more, they found that this James, little James Lettinger, had some sort of connection with another James who had lived in World War II, who was killed in World War II. So when they would ask little James questions about what was going on in his dreams, what was going on, what the connection was, he would say things like, who shot you down, James? And he would say, the Japanese. Well, how do you know it was the Japanese? Because you can tell by the flag on the back of their plane. So there were little details that little James Lettinger was able to start describing when he was 4 years old, 5 years old, that were just not able to be duplicated. The family also were very conservative Christians and didn't believe in reincarnation. They didn't have television, so there were very limited areas of where he would have gotten this influence from as well. James Lettinger would sit in his car seat, and he would strap himself in as if he was getting ready for a takeoff. When his parents got him a birthday gift of a little airplane, he said, oh, look at, the parents would say, oh, look at the little bomb underneath. And so little James Lettinger would say, that's not a bomb, Mom, that's a dwop tank. Knowing exact details. And they brought him to a World War II museum, which is in Louisiana, in New Orleans. And he would look around on the planes, examining it in the same way that a World War II pilot would examine his planes. So the father was very, very skeptical about this particular this kind of stuff. Wasn't so fast to just say, wow, reincarnation. He was very, very hesitant. And so he started doing some research. And he brought his son, James, to a researcher who has been known to be very cautious in her stipulations about these types of things. Her name is Carol Bowman, and she vouched for the authenticity of what he was saying. So James's father took it a step further. He started Googling around the internet, and he found that James, the James that little James claimed to be a reincarnation of, that platoon, he found out what platoon he used to be a part of in the Second World War, and found that every year, during the summer or whatever it was, they would have a reunion. Anyone who was still living from that particular platoon would get together for a reunion. And so the father thought, you know what? I'm going to bring my little James there and just see what goes on, see what happens. And so when little James is brought to this reunion, he starts identifying the people that are there. So that's Brian Greenblatt. I could tell by his voice. And he started identifying the people that were walking into the room. There was another incident where they found out that the James, that little James was connected with in the Second World War, had a sister that was still living. Her name was Anne. And the father decided, you know what, why don't I find out her information, get them talking on the phone, see if there's any sort of anything that comes out from that. And when they got to talking on the phone, Anne had sent little James a bunch of pictures, old pictures from growing up. James knew all about who was in the pictures and everything like that. And then he called, when they talked on the phone, little James calls her Annie. And Anne said that the only person in her entire life that called her Annie and not Anne was her brother James, who had passed away in the Second World War, out of Iwo Jima. And so I'm not here to endorse or discredit any of these stories or the accounts. But what we're saying is that the concept that life is not just where we are in the here and now, that is something that we could have been here before and there's a possibility that we might come back again, is something that even in mainstream society, among very highly credentialed mainstream researchers, are also considering. There's more to life than meets the eye. It's a fascinating idea. So what about Judaism? Where does Jewish thought fit into all of this? Jewish thought sees the soul as an immortal continuum. You were you, or you existed as a spiritual being prior to coming into your body, during your time in your body, and you will continue to exist as a spiritual entity after leaving your body. We tend to think of ourselves as human beings that are having a spiritual experience, and the opposite is true. We are spiritual creatures, essentially spiritual beings, that temporarily, right now, are having a human experience. But the soul, the story of the soul, and the story of you begins before your birth date and ends long after the day of your death. So the word Gilgul in our tradition is similar to the word circle in Hebrew, and implies a continuous circle, a continuous cycle of the soul. Truth be told, the concept of the cycle of life, of nature, you find it all over the place in creation. I'm from Florida originally and currently. And I went to yeshiva, went to school in the Northeast. And I remember the first weekend that I was there, I saw for the first time in my life, snow. Whoa! And you look out in the snow. I'm not talking about when it's pretty. I'm talking about when the sky is gray and the trees are dead and the ground is all white and muddy. It looks like death. And in the heart of winter, if you didn't know any better, you'd think that's the end. That's it. Lo and behold, springtime comes around, and there's new life. And the cycle repeats itself year after year. So just when you thought that everything was over, it starts over again. The cycle of life, the cycle that after death there is life, finds itself in many places in Jewish tradition. Rabbi Moshe Isserles, the Ramah, says very interesting things. Says one of the reasons that the Jewish people are compared to the moon, one of the ways in which we are compared to the moon, or humanity can be compared to the moon, is because the cycle of the moon. Just when you think the moon is gone, just when you think there's no more moon anymore, it's born again. The rebirth. Then it gets bigger and smaller, and then seems to disappear, and then reappears. And so this cycle of life and disappearance is something embedded in our lives. The cells of the human body are constantly dying and replenishing themselves. All of nature indicates this pattern of life followed by death, followed by life. In Jewish tradition, a soul can be reincarnated several times in order to correct certain things that took place, blemishes in a previous lifetime, or to perfect something that was left unperfected during a certain lifetime, that it prohibits its mission, that didn't allow it to come to the pinnacle of where that soul was meant to be. Either something we did that we shouldn't have done, or something that we should have done that we left incomplete. Reincarnation has been a staple of Jewish tradition since the beginning. Even Josephus, the first century Jewish historian, writes that reincarnation was an accepted belief in Jewish circles even in his days. The Targum Onkelos, a first century Aramaic translation of the Bible, makes references to reincarnation as well. So this is not something that, oh, Judaism has adapted. See that it's a popular idea in occult and paranormal circles, New Age circles, and wants to sort of get in on the trend. No, reincarnation has been a part of our tradition since the beginning. Now, there were periods in Jewish history where Jewish mysticism was not something that was widely known. In fact, in many circles for many years, until really the 1500s, Kabbalistic thought, Jewish mysticism, was something that was taught on a very private basis, teacher to student. Wide publishing wasn't available. And so some scholars, some sages, never had all that much access to Jewish mysticism. But all those that did endorse the idea of reincarnation. The Sefer HaBahir, which is the first Kabbalistic book that was published, it was in the 12th century, takes reincarnation as a given. This is a staple of Judaism. The Zohar, another classic work, one of the most classic works of Jewish mysticism, is filled with reincarnation references. On the verse from the Torah, when the Torah says that visiting the iniquities of the fathers unto the sons, the Zohar says that this refers to the soul that reincarnates several times and experiences it not only in one lifetime, but in a different lifetime to achieve its rectification. So there are many instances in the Bible text itself where Jewish mysticism alludes and says this is talking about reincarnation. Adam and Eve give birth to Cain and Abel. Abel is killed by Cain. And then the Torah says about their next son, Seth, Chase, that Seth was born instead of Abel, whom Cain slew. And the Jewish mystics say, what does it mean that he was born instead? It says that Seth was a reincarnation of Abel. There are various instances throughout the Tanakh, throughout the Jewish Bible, that reincarnation is woven into, is displayed in, if you have the right glasses on. And the Jewish mystics, the Jewish mystical texts are our lens in order to see who was who, where the connections are between all of these people. So here's kind of how it works. Adam, the first human being, was a collective general soul who had all the future possible souls within him in that original state. Then he transgresses, the world becomes fragmented, and in order to perfect it, it's going to take many people over the course of many years to bring it to its pinnacle state. Really, if Adam just had obeyed what he was supposed to do, the world would have been Mashiach times, godliness would have been revealed to everyone, and it would have been easy peasy. Just a few minutes, few hours. But since that wasn't the route that Adam decided to go, then the outcome is many people, many years, perfecting little areas of the world. And so on the soul, the general collective soul of Adam, we could think that there are souls. The one way to envision it is that there are souls that come from various locations in the person, the spiritual person of Adam. So there are people that come from the head parts of the soul. There are people that come from the hand parts of the soul. There are people that come from the feet part of the soul. And truth be told, there are many people that are alive at the same time even that are part of the same soul. It's almost like a bonfire. So a bonfire, you can light 10 candles from a single bonfire. They all have the same essence because they're all kindled, they're all brought about from that same bonfire. Or you can have one root and one trunk of a tree that has 10 branches. They all have the same essence. They're all rooted in the same place. But they all have sort of these independent realities. And so our tradition teaches that there are 600,000 soul roots, Jewish soul roots. Well, if you don't have to be a mathematician to know that there's more than 600,000 Jews in the world right now, about 14 million. That means that right here, right now, there are souls in the world that are rooted in the same place. They're part of the same soul. One of the places that we see that is in husband and wife. Husband and wife, the union of husband and wife is said to be not a union, but a reunion. It's one soul getting back together, finding each other. That's one place where you see it. Sometimes the family and friends that we have in our life, people who play significant roles in our lives, that it's because of the fact that we are rooted in the same soul. And oftentimes the people that play a very significant role in your life, this is not the first time that you're going through that with them. There's almost like this cosmic connection that maintains, that stays, that people who are affiliated together stay together in order to correct certain aspects of their soul, different aspects of their relationship and situations that need perfecting. So the same people that played a role, it may not be the exact same. In one life, you might be mother and daughter, father and son, teacher and student. And the following life, you could be teacher and student, brother and sister, whatever it is, friend and companion. So the dynamics change, but those soul roots interacting with each other is what brings about their perfection. So reincarnation is considered to be, on the one hand, it's a corrective measure. In other words, if there's something that a person didn't live up to, they did something that they shouldn't have done, reincarnation can be one of the mechanisms that God uses to restore that soul spark, and perfect it, bring it back up to. There are various things that happen to a person when a person passes away. The life is reviewed, and we see how they lived up to everything, how well they were in sync with who they were meant to be. And one of the possible corrective measures is the measure of reincarnation. It's considered a kindness. In fact, the word chesed, kindness, and the word Gilgul have the same numeric value. Kindness and reincarnation go together. God's giving you another chance. So we need to try to do everything that we can, certainly in our own life, to live up to the expectations, to live up to the promise that we are meant to be. But at the same time, to recognize that one of the corrective measures, should we not live up to that, that God can choose to bestow upon us, is reincarnation. Now, when a person reincarnates, it's not like you think about in the movies. We tend to think of the soul as sort of like this Casper the Friendly Ghost that lives inside of us, kind of an us that looks like us, the way that it's depicted in the cartoons, when Wile E. Coyote falls off the cliff and a see-through white version of Wile E. Coyote emerges from that. That's how we think of the soul. Souls aren't really like that. Souls much more like a spark that we say is connected with one bonfire. And so when a person passes, all of the elements of themselves that were perfected, that they did live up to in the proper way, those are rewarded and experience the spiritual bliss that they needed to, that they are deserving of. And if there's any aspect of the person's personality, any aspect of that spiritual source inside of us that needs correction, well, they can, that part of them, that aspect of their soul, can be incarnated with a completely new existence, a completely new perspective on things, a completely new identity, a completely new consciousness. And so in our tradition, those who have passed don't really have, each individual incarnation doesn't really have a direct connection with who you are or were in a previous life. There's no mitzvah to go find out who you were in a previous life. And in fact, that's something that is oftentimes discouraged by our sages. Why? Because if you found out that someone did something to you in a prior life, wouldn't you be upset about that? Like, oh, you're the reason I was dead. You're the reason I died. And so, to find out about ourselves in prior lives is not something that is something that's really an encouraged thing to do. In fact, there's a debate amongst our sages whether that's something that's even possible to do, whether God has sort of hidden that towards only to the particularly righteous individuals. Righteous individuals have given indicators of who they were in prior lives, and there have been many Jewish mystical texts written that have endorsed the idea, that have said which biblical character was, or which sage was, who they were in their prior lifetime. But But it's not something that the average person should go out and explore, to try to go get hypnotized or to go to Brian Weiss conference and try to see who you were in the past life. It's not, it shouldn't be at the forefront of our minds. Another question that's asked about reincarnation very commonly is, what happens with resurrection? One of the fundamental features of our faith is we believe that when Mashiach comes, that during that time period in the Messianic era, that every person who has ever lived will resurrect, that those souls who have passed away will once again be reunited with the bodies that they once inhabited. So you think to yourself, well, if I've been many people throughout the generations, which one of me comes back? And the answer is, and it's a debate in the Zohar, but the answer is all of them. Because each soul, again, it's not like Wile E. Coyote in the cartoons. It's one aspect of yourself that needs correction is incarnated into a new individual with its own new consciousness, its own new identity. It happened to come from the same root. It came from the same spark, came from the same soul, but it's its own entity. So you, as you are now, are one entity. And you have your own consciousness, and you will process and receive the reward for all of your deeds at the end of your individual life. But there may be some aspects of you that get their own identity. They get their own, think about it like donating an organ. And if a person did donate an organ, you gave your kidney. So fine, it came from you. So there is an aspect of your life now enlivening somebody else. But that doesn't mean that you are living inside of them. You are providing life. So if you think about that in sort of spiritual terms, with a full consciousness, that is sort of the idea of reincarnation and how it works. It's not ghostly you goes now and inhabits a different ghostly body. It's an aspect of yourself that needs correction, is granted a new identity in order to uplift the totality of that soul. Okay. So I would like to open it up to questions, but to just conclude with an idea. One of the reasons why in our tradition we don't focus so much about who we were in a prior life or who we're going to be in a future life is because our tradition focuses on the now. A lot of times we like to think about the afterlife or our prior lives. It's almost as a cop-out. A lot of people, if you make a class about the afterlife, you fill up a room. You make a class about things that are spiritual and otherworldly, you fill up the room. You make a class about practical halacha, practical Jewish law, not necessarily to get the same crowd. Why is it? Because we like to focus on stuff that's peripheral. We like to focus, what was I in my past life? What was I in my future life? But we got to think of what's going on in my life right now. What's the point of knowing who you were if you're still struggling, if you don't properly know who you are? Thank you very much. If there are any questions about this particular topic, the door is open.
I know this is kind of funny, but when Moshiach comes, you get Trias HaMesim. Yeah, so do you go with your first husband or your second husband or whatever husband you happen to be married to at that time?
It's not funny. I was first. Really.
No, I understand that. It's a very good question. That will be one of the things that Mashiach will help us work out, to see which souls and how all that gets put together. Excellent question. Because the truth is that we like to think about it in our lives, and it's much more romantic sounding, especially when a person gets married, their first time married, you say, like, I found the one, right? My soulmate. We use these terms, and it's nice terms, and it sounds very romantic, but the truth of the matter is, there are multiple people that might be fitting for one individual. A person may have more than one soulmate. And so when a person loses their husband or there's a divorce or whatever the case may be, and you get married a second time, it's not like, well, this is like the second, this is not my real soulmate, this is just sort of some, no. It doesn't work like that. There could be multiple people that a person is fitting towards. So Mashiach will help you. I guarantee you Mashiach will help you when that time comes. And I don't mean that in a funny way. I mean that in a very real way. Yeah.
Along those lines, since we've all been reincarnated, so who comes back? All of our reincarnate, like?
Right. That was one of the things that we kind of touched upon, was that each time you come back, it's like a spark coming back with its own consciousness. And each individual existence that you had with its own consciousness, its own thought patterns, its own worldview, its own perspective, each spark comes back in the body that it was incarnated in.
When Mashiach comes,
yeah.
So you'll have numerous husbands and wives.
Well, yeah, certain things will, yeah, the ones that you, not at the same time, the one that your spark married in the 5th century will be, you're not going to be married to them also. Yeah.
You spoke about the idea of a soul coming down to rectify something in the past, share your soul. Which mistakes would we be fixing?
So each soul has the mission to complete the 613 commandments that were meant to be utilized, to be working towards fulfilling all of the commandments of the Torah. So if there was something in our lives that we had not done properly or not done or even done well in action, but maybe not perfectly in thought or in speech, that might be something that needs to be corrected. God measures each person according to their ability, according to the challenges that they were subject to. Not everybody's graded on the same cookie cutter system. And so God will determine what is going to be the best way to take any sort of corrective measures that need to be taken. Now, one question, by the way, that reminded me of a question closely related to it. There's a very common question. If I am here primarily to correct something perhaps that happened in a prior life, or there's a specific mission that I've been designated here for, and we're also told that it's not encouraged to go out exploring who you were in a prior life, well, how am I supposed to know? What am I here to correct? How do I know? And so one of the ways that our sages say is like a magic potion or a magic worldview, magic elixir, to knowing your life mission, to knowing one of the key reasons why you are here. And one of the ways that you can explore that is in what area, particular in Torah and mitzvahs, is most challenging for you. Where do you find that it's so difficult to do this thing? There's some mitzvahs that come to us so easy. Not only easy, we enjoy doing them. Whatever your particular mitzvah is, that you just enjoy doing. And then some of them are like, oh, I gotta do that, oh my gosh. And it takes a real willpower to overcome yourself and to actually do. In those mitzvahs, in those where there's the challenge, in those where there's the friction inside of yourself that has to determine, am I gonna really do this or am I not gonna do this? And how am I gonna do this? Am I gonna put any effort into this? Whatever it is, that may very well be the exact reason behind your mission in this world. The area that you focus on most, we're all supposed to be doing the mitzvahs as best as possible, fulfilling the commandments as we're best able. We have to try to pursue all of them. But there are some that are particularly hard, and that might be an area of particular focus. If every time you take out your wallet to give tzedakah, and George Washington's like, ugh, because naturally you're more of a stingy person, that might be an area to work on. That might be, it's so hard, but that itself might be very linked to your mission here. So one of the ways in which we find out what our mission is and what we're trying to correct from a prior lifetime are those areas that challenge us the most in this life. Yes?
Just wanted to get your opinion. If you're learning Torah, Tanakh, and you hear about anybody from those times and somebody really connects with you or different Rebbe or Rebbetzins or anything like that from the past, I really just, you're just like, I get it. Like, I feel just close with that type of a person. Do you think that that has, like, you could be sharing some sort of a neshama with them, or that's, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's a very real
thing. Sometimes, like, you read about somebody, you're like, I get it. Like, I could totally see myself in that person, and you just have a connection with whatever, Rivka Meinu, anybody, you know.
Sure. So, one area where we find that very clearly is some of the Hasidic masters, particularly the early Hasidic masters, that they would be particular about who would be their Hasidim. You know, now everyone who puts on a hat and jacket becomes a Hasid. But back then, there were certain groups that were, the way in which the person presented themselves, their character traits, their personality features, might be more in line with that Hasidic master than with me. So I might send you over there because that soul connection, that perspective, that essence of where you're coming from has more of a connection to those types of teachings. Some are drawn in different directions. I don't necessarily know that is connecting with the individual on an individual level, that you're connected somehow with that Rebbe or that biblical figure, but that your soul and your purpose here may be more in line with the same nature as that particular person's. That you might find yourself, you know, some of the challenges that person went through resonating with you. Imagine somebody who has family struggles reading about Joseph and the strife that he has with his brothers and all of the troubles and trials and tribulations that he goes through throughout his life, that might resonate with somebody who themselves is going through some family struggles or who themselves has gone through trials and tribulations. And so this is a very important, on a soul level, this is a very important consideration as well, to think that you may have more of a connection with these particular teachings or these particular attributes than with others. Doesn't mean that you block off the others, but yeah, it's something to use for your own empowerment, to say, look, you know, I really resonate with the story of Joseph. I really resonate with the story of Rivka, whatever it is, and how can I live up to and be more like that figure, being that I kind of resonate towards their personality and the experiences that they went through.
So. The area of interest to me, and I've discussed this with others in our congregation, we actually have a decent number of us who are Jews by choice, and the question of whether we are the reincarnation of a Jewish soul born into a family that wasn't Jewish and have felt that draw back in. I've felt it myself, and I even went as far as doing one of the DNA things, and I don't have a drop of Jewish blood. 1% Tamil, Sri Lankan Tamil, but
there you go.
But not a drop of Jewish blood. So it's not an ancestor thing. It has to be a soul thing, I guess, because has anybody done any kind of research into that, or, you know, hypnotize people in those kind of circumstances and revealed that's...
Sure. So first of all, the idea of a Jew and becoming a Jew or a Jewish soul, remember that when a convert converts, it doesn't say a non-Jew that converts. In our tradition, it doesn't say a non-Jew that converts to Judaism that becomes something different. Say a convert who converts. Meaning it's more like passive. It's talking about that the person already inherently was a convert, was basically a Jewish soul that was just kind of like, it was covered over by life scenarios or the family that it was born into. It has nothing to do with the genetics that a person has. A person is genetically, a convert is genetically related to their parents, right? But spiritually is different from them, right? Jewish soul and not a Jewish soul, different things. That's fine. That doesn't make one better or worse. There is an idea that the individual that on a soul level was already had this connection with Judaism, with Torah in particular, and that the conversion process and the situations that they found themselves in that galvanized them to become Jewish in an outward way were already embedded in the person to begin with. Souls are not the way that we would tend to think that, well, obviously the people that I'm related to are the people that soul-wise I'm also most connected to. It's not always the case. In fact, oftentimes it's not the case. You see families that are very different. Each character in the family is a very different person. Just because you're genetically related, that's nice, that's good. But that doesn't necessarily mean that soul-wise that there's a perfect fit amongst everyone in the family. So genetics and souls are two very different things. So it's very possible that 23andMe, yeah, maybe showed you that you're part Sri Lankan, right?
Couldn't believe it.
Right, like, that's pretty wild. But that has nothing to do with your spiritual identity. And that is when we talk about souls and we talk about reincarnation, that's the focus of where we are. There's no way to trace that, per se.
That's why I was wondering if anyone had done any regression type stuff on people.
There are certain righteous individuals throughout the course of history who have been able to tell people who they were. It was on a need-to-know sort of basis to correct a specific thing that this righteous individual thought that if you knew these specific details, it would enhance you in this life. It was all about this life. It wasn't just for, oh, I went to a conference and I got hypnotized and decided, you know, to find out who I was. I was Sri Lankan, actually. The idea is that they would tell the people only to correct something that was going on in this world. And so certainly the fact that your Judaism, and you said a large number of your community's Judaism, yeah, has been by choice, it's a beautiful thing to see people come back together and reunite in who they really are, essentially, and be able to express that in the form of conversion.
I felt drawn to Judaism before I even met the first Jew.
It's a
okay. I read Leon Uris's Exodus when I was 17, and was just enthralled. And I didn't understand exactly why. I didn't meet my husband till in college.
It's a powerful thing. Oftentimes, with people who actually do complete the conversion process, you ask them, "Well, what was it that got you going?" They say, "I just kind of felt it all along. I didn't hear an inspiring lecture. I didn't attend some Jewish conference or whatnot. Those things don't hurt. But it was something I always felt deep inside of me." That's a soul thing. And that's one of the values of being a convert, is you get to see it in real life, that soul that was inside of you be able to express itself now in full fruition.
Hi, thank you so much. First, sure. I have two questions. The first is, what happens when we have completed our mission? The soul has, all the different parts of the soul have completed. And the second is, are we ever reincarnated into like an animal? Or like if we did something wrong, do we regress back into something not as human?
Great questions. So in 3 minutes... The first question that you ask, what happens when the soul finally gets to its final fulfillment? That soul, in its totality and in its completion, embraces and is able to experience God in the ultimate sense, without any sort of distraction, without any sort of defect. In the fullest and most complete way, that soul is able to experience God, which is a completely different experience that it would have. Imagine you win tickets to a concert, front row seats. You win front row seats to the opera. Well, that's really great if you like the opera. If you don't like the opera, it's torture. Right? It's the same experience, right? You're in the front row, but if you like the opera, You know, the more you like the opera, the more of an enjoyable experience it's going to be. The less you like the opera, the less of an enjoyable experience it is. And so when the soul fully, in every aspect, has corrected itself, perfected itself, it enjoys the experience of God in the fullest possible sense. And that's an amazing thing. That's the fruition. As far as being reincarnated into an animal, there is such an idea mentioned in Jewish tradition as a form of punishment, not something that we should be exploring, you know, in any sort of real way or wondering. You know, some people look at it as like, almost look at it as a reward. They're like, when I come in my next life, I want to come as a butterfly. Like, well, it doesn't really work like that. You know, some of the ways in which everything's done is measure for measure. And so if a person was engaging in behaviors that were animalistic, one of the rectifications may be to be incarnated into an animal. That's a form of punishment as opposed to something good. All right, so let's end on that. There's mincha and a great retreat that still awaits. Have a wonderful day, everybody.
Please visit myjli.com to learn more about JLI's multiple educational offerings and TorahCafe.com to view highlights and lectures from past retreats.